Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in 1961, in his farewell address, Dwight Eisenhower warned of the rise of the military-industrial complex, the Army's close ties with business and profit. He may not have envisioned another kind of partnership that began to emerge just a generation later. Let's call it the entertainment industrial complex, or the military entertainment complex. In War Play, a new book, Corey Mead describes that way in which the Army has used video games and technology to recruit, train, and even alter the way war is conducted in the modern age. Corey Mead is professor of English at Baruch College. He joins us now. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
And before we discuss the history and the usage of the games that you write about, can you describe the gameplay of one of these games for us? Is it done online, on a home console, at an arcade? Are you alone? Are you playing as a group? For people who don't do these games, what's the experience like?
Well, it's funny because there's such a huge variety of games that are actually used. So I would imagine when most people, especially people that don't know games too well, think about video games, they think about these kind of like violent first-person shooter games that are what's called massively multiplayer, so where hundreds of thousands of people can play at once. There's a version of those massively multiplayer games used in the militaries. So in some training cases, you'll have, say, 100 cadets in a room, each with their own computer, 100 trainees. And there will be this networked game going, so everyone's participating in the game, but they're controlling their own individual avatar. So that's one form of games, but there's a huge variety. Some games are for language learning these days. Some games are for training in cultural communication in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. There are games now especially being developed for soldiers who are returning home and dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder and reintegration into family and civilian life. So those games can be played individually on a home computer or not.
So historically, the military became interested in video games not as a recruiting tool. Oh, kids think games are cool. Let's, you know, use them to try to get people to enlist. But as a training device for people who are already in the service?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, the recruitment thing was a relatively late addition, and there was one game used for that. But yeah, it's far more about training and about education too.
And there's this uneasy relationship, I gather, between the early internet community and the military-industrial complex. The Army needs the tech-savviest people on their side, and often those are young hackers who you might not think of as the most likely people to get into military stuff. So how did that relationship develop?
I mean, I wouldn't say uneasy historically. It's that the military for decades was far ahead of industry in terms of developing or funding the most cutting-edge technologies. So the game industry grew out of military funding. But what happened in the middle of the 90s is that the game industry surpassed the military in terms of new technologies. And so that relationship has shifted so that the teacher has kind of become the teachee, and now the military consults with the game companies for the latest technologies.
So much of modern warfare is conducted in front of a computer screen, it seems like. How much has video game design influenced the design of the actual tools of war?
I mean, I would say that in terms of things using controllers like, you know, the old joysticks and now the more modern game consoles for some pilots and things like that, there's definitely been an influence there. Although it's less about, hey, these kids know how to use video games, let's design this, than a lot of modern game consoles and joysticks are simply the most cutting-edge design for what they want to achieve.
Does it go the other way, too, that video games get crafted now to simulate the tools being used in combat?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, in the case of game makers, a game that can have sort of this stamp of, hey, we have stuff that's exactly the same as it is in the military is a real badge of pride.
Listeners, if you're a vet in, let's say, the last 20 or 30 years, because a lot of this really starts in the 80s, how are video games or similar technology used in your recruitment or your training, or how do you see them reflected in video game pop culture today? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Corey Mead, professor of English at Baruch College and author now of the book War Play, 212-433-9692. How does an English college, English professor wind up writing a book like this anyway?
I actually got to the issue through literacy, and I was new in grad school and looking at new literacy practices, so what my students were ostensibly into. And there's a group of people arguing that video games represent a really powerful new literacy practice, and it's one that any number of our students are far more comfortable with than they are with reading a book. So that became the – sorry.
It's a video literacy as opposed to a verbal or
textual.
Language or – literacy.
Absolutely. It's one that people argue is calling upon a number of skills that aren't usually appreciated, which is that you're interacting with text, but there's also the visual, there's the aural, and so people argue it's a lot more complex.
So all those high school kids getting C averages, they can say, you know, I'm very visually literate.
Exactly.
And it's an interesting side note, but in the book, don't you write about how the military led the way in terms of education in certain respects, like the first standardized tests were a military innovation. Oh, thanks a lot.
Well, there's that. Yeah, and everything related to the tying together of education and technology stems from at least military funding. Ed tech as a field wouldn't exist without it. So you know, starting from using computers for educational purposes to whatever cutting-edge apps we're using today, this stems from military origins. And so the same thing's happening now, I argue, in the book, that with the military adopting games for education much earlier than most other industries did, they've been leading the way once again.
And on our comments page, one of our listeners writes, the military recruited Hollywood during World War II to make training and propaganda films, so this is hardly new. Mm-hmm. Only the medium is relatively new. Do you see it in that historical context?
Absolutely. And I think – so it's not new per se. What's new this time around is the degree of immersiveness that video games can afford. And, you know, a movie can be 2 hours and a game can be 60 hours of gameplay where you're more fully encompassed in the game.
And one of the things you're very clear about is that this isn't a dumbing down of war.
Right.
In fact, in many ways, these video games are doing a good job of achieving the kind of quick decision making and stressful situation recreation that occur in actual combat?
Well, that's the idea, that if you strip content away for a moment and think about what it takes to play one of these video games, which are incredibly complex, that dealing with a chaotic mass of data and trying to figure out how to navigate that data in an effective, relatively quick way are the skills that people are taught when they play these. And so that translates well to the modern battlefield, which is a jumble of chaos and data.
Nigel in Summit. You're on WNYC. Hello, Nigel.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Good.
My question, I'm not a vet, sorry, but question is whether the military has developed any kind of games that are related to soft power, as in I can understand the value of tactical and strategic warfare development, but a lot of video games that are out nowadays are a lot more about the backstory and interacting with people, and I was just wondering.
So when you say soft power, these would be diplomacy games, that kind of thing?
Well, if any of these games involve that kind of diplomacy of working with people on the ground to build things or help build relationships or anything like that.
It's a really interesting question.
It actually, the answer is yes, and it's been a pretty huge component of the games that have been developed since, 2001. It's because the soldiers themselves are now called upon to do, five different jobs, many of which involve principles of counterinsurgency, so protecting local populations or building local populations. So the games now are supposed to teach things like understanding local cultural cues, right, or basic language skills or gestures, things like taking off your sunglasses when addressing someone in Iraq was considered as polite, right? And so if you don't take them off, you're being rude right off the start. So the games address a number of these issues.
Thank you, Nigel. David in Morris County, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a retired Army officer, and I have a little bit of familiarity with some weapon systems that are under development. And one day I come home from my civilian job now. My son is playing one of the later Call of Duty type games. And the realism was so great, I recognized this prototype weapon called the XM-25, on the screen. And I asked him, I said, hey, are you shooting an XM-25? And he looked back at me with that typical teenage look like, but what do you know about it? And I said, Dad, I first of all, I worked on that program. Second off, that's not even issued to the Army yet. And here you are in Call of Duty, you know, firing it. I actually gave him tips about how to employ it properly that he was unfamiliar with. So,
and then he gave you tips.
Interesting how it flows.
So that's an incredible story, Corey.
Right.
Right, where the video game somehow knew about the technology that was actually being developed in the real military and jumped ahead of it?
Yeah, well, I don't know in that specific instance how that would have happened, but I do know that the game companies very much like to have as consultants ex-military members.
So, and David, thank you. That's an amazing story. So it talks to how integrated the game producers are with the actual military.
And I think it talks to how much game makers can pay versus what an Army salary might be.
So people who leave some of these design functions, jobs in the military might go to game makers. Is that one revolving door now?
That's certainly a revolving door, or more likely be used as paid consultants, well-paid consultants.
Dennis in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, how you doing? I'm a captain in the United States Army. I just returned 3 weeks ago from Afghanistan, and we used Xbox controllers to control our weapon systems. And it's interesting how influential the gaming community can be, because you were saying earlier about how the training has evolved to where the trainer becomes the trainee. And it's absolutely right, because when we were doing our train up, it just felt like this heavy video game that you're playing. But as to going to like Call of Duty or something like that, they are very well consulted, as you guys were just saying.
Do you find in your experience, Dennis, and welcome back, by the way, I'm sure you're still in all kinds of transition shock if you just got back from Afghanistan a few weeks ago. Glad you're back safe. Did you ever find that working with the screens desensitizes you to actual violence? This is a criticism that comes up, at least in, you know, the civilian world, that it makes it too easy to pull the trigger and, you know, not think about the potential collateral damage or any other kind of injury or death that might be caused, because we see violence at a distance, a kind of emotionally safe distance using the screen. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, you when you're looking through the screen, it kind of separates you from being on the ground. But we only had, a few vehicles that had those weapon systems. So most of the time that was just an Overwatch system, but you're right that it kind of does, it separates you from actually being on the ground and kind of puts you back in that mind frame of, oh, I'm just looking at a screen, and it separates you from, you know, from actually what's going on the ground.
Dennis, I really appreciate your call. Call us again now that you're back. And, of course, that brings up the whole topic of drones, mm-hmm. which is so controversial these days. Do you get into that at all in the book?
I don't in the book, but a couple months ago I spent a week down with the drone pilots down in New Mexico. They were doing their training, and you know, a lot of them, they were so sensitive to that criticism. They'd been well primed to rebut that criticism, and their rebuttal was that with the kind of high-powered cameras that drones have and the fact that they track their potential targets for weeks on end and get to know their movements and see them with their families, that they actually have a more intimate relationship with the enemy than they did before. A lot of them, you know, used to fly fighter jets, so they argue that this actually brings them into closer contact than when they were 20,000 feet above and couldn't see a thing. So, you know, it's a talking point on the one hand, and on the other hand, you can see the element of truth in that, that they talked about the shock sometimes when someone will turn around and look at the camera right before the missile strikes them and how that's a bit unsettling.
The line between theater of war and regular life.
Narrower
than it was in the past. I mean, it's not the Civil War where you're standing on the battlefield and
right.
looking at the other guys in the eye. But I can imagine it would be a very powerful moment when, knowingly or not, somebody you've been following with a camera for a potential drone strike on the area
right.
suddenly looks and is staring you in the eye.
Yeah, right before you get them.
So where do you... Is there, to finish up, is there a connection between our all professional army, volunteer army, and the rise of video games, the move away from a draft, and the rise of interactive interactive technology, you know, that kind of came about the same time. But is there a connection?
I would say that there's certainly a connection, but I think the bigger issue is that there's a generation of people who think that they're interacting with the military in a profound way via these video games, or think they know something about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but aren't actually involved with the 1% of the population that is fighting these wars. So in some ways, the video games can obscure actual knowledge about the wars that are being fought in our names and the people that are fighting them.
And there are even games that deal with PTSD, right?
Yeah, that's a big push right now.
So there's a perversion there, isn't there, that the desensitized nature of war aided by computer games creates a kind of PTSD that's then addressed by computer games.
You could frame it that way, yeah.
All right. Corey Mead, professor of English at Baruch College. He has written the book War Play, in which he describes ways in which the military has used video games and technology to recruit, train, and even alter the way war is conducted in the modern age. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Ruben Santiago Hudson, Stephen McKinley Henderson, and Arthur Yorinks on producing August Wilson's 10-play American Century Cycle for radio. We will talk about these classic plays and their themes and the production values as WNYC turns them into audio. Stay with us.